This is Carl Smiley from Summit, Oregon. You are listening to KORCLPFM 105.9, Corvallis, Oregon, streaming at KORCFM.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Hello, listeners. This past week was a daily slog through the icy cold, foggy mornings looking for the sky, looking for the sun. I went to the city meetings looking for clarity, and my quest had mixed results. But right now, I see a neon light that says the Corvallis Civics Cafe is open and serving hot food, and a quick look at the specials says something about elephant tail. There might even be dessert at the end, so let's grab a seat and fill up on city politics. On Monday, December 2nd, the City Council meeting started with a hearing about community development block grants, known by the acronym CDBG. From reading the packet for the meeting and listening to the hearing, I've learned that each year, cities across the country receive funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that is used to support low to moderate income housing development. The cities are required to hold two public hearings a year about how previous funds were used and how future funds might be used. After the mayor officially opened the hearing, Corvallis Department of Community Development employee Nissa Paul, whose title is Housing Grant Coordinator, gave a presentation about the CDBG program. She stated she was there for public input about the program for 2025 to 2026, and noted that requests for proposals recently opened with a due date of December 20th of this year. This was the first I heard about this, and I'm wondering how the information has been shared with the organizations who might be interested in applying for the funding. Also, how can they make requests for funding when we don't know what funds are available? Ms. Paul clearly stated that the federal government has yet to release the grant amounts, and said the grants are anticipated to be similar to those of the last grant cycle, which totaled $750,000. I wonder, can we expect the federal government will continue to share money, given the changes afoot in 2025? It appeared Ms. Paul was anticipating public input, but there was no one there to give any. Is that normal? If there is money to share, what organizations are going to apply for it, and why were they not at the meeting? Was no one there due to lack of outreach? Lack of interest? Maybe those who follow this program closely, such as the Unity Shelter, have more information, but it struck me as odd that the city held this hearing and no one came to comment. Is that another example of a lack of public participation or lack of outreach on the part of the city? If anyone knows, I'd love to hear from you. After the oddly performative public hearing on the community development block grants, we moved on to community comments. Several people spoke to urge the City Council to acknowledge the public's concern about expenses of the Civic Campus project and the desire to keep the current City Hall building in place. Steve Clark, Corvallis resident and co-chair of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force, presented the Council with recommendations for amendments to their resolution on the Civic Campus layout choice. High praise to Mr. Clark for continuing to show up and push the Council to acknowledge the feedback from the community. A contingency of residents were in the room to express concerns about the newly proposed changes to zoning in South Corvallis. This is a topic I am sure we will return to soon, and it was the subject of a combined City-County Planning Commission meeting which occurred last week on December 3rd. Onward with the City Council meeting review. On Monday, the City Council took the next step forward in the process of building a civic campus. Journalist Ella Hutcherson covered the basics of the meeting in the Gazette Times on Thursday, December 5th, in her article titled, Corvallis Picks Layout for New Civic Campus. During the meeting, after nearly an hour debating and voting on amendments to the original resolution, the Council voted 7-2 to accept a particular layout for a civic campus on Madison Avenue, between 5th and 6th Streets, and the resolution includes the words, removing City Hall. As the councilors discussed the resolution prior to the vote, they danced around the concept of removal of the City Hall. For example, Ward 9 Councilor Tony Cadena stated that there has yet to be a decision about tear down versus relocate. I'd like to see that happen. How would they move that building? while some councilors opined that if the public knew how expensive it will be to keep the current City Hall, they would likely change their tune about preserving it. Additionally, it was noted that as the current City Hall is over 100 years old and listed on the local registry of historic buildings, any changes to it must be put to a hearing of our Historic Resources Commission, a decision of which, ironically, can be changed by a majority vote of the City Council. Facepalm! Oh, hey, yeah. No one in the room decided to take on the discussion of the carbon footprint of a project such as this, and no one rallied to the flag raised by community member Phil Emerson that the most sustainable building is the one that already exists. There's a metaphor for the process we are in, something like, to eat an elephant, start at the tail. I think the elephant in the room is the money, but it is also the current City Hall building. No one believes they can eat an elephant, just like no one believes the city can continue to move forward with this project. The council keeps telling itself that the people of Corvallis will eventually accept this project if they just keep feeding us small, unidentifiable parts of the elephant. In the end, City Council voted to move forward with the idea of a civic campus concept, the one with the $189 million price tag, the one that removes City Hall, to build a police facility on that side of the street and a civic administration building on the other side of the street. In an ironic twist, they amended the resolution to add language about listening more carefully to the public and to re-engaging some form of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force to help with the next steps of the process. Ward 5's Charlyn Ellis and Ward 7's Paul Schaefer were the dissenting votes, with Ellis holding fast to her insistence to focus on one facility at a time, and Schaefer arguing for closer attention to public input. That got spicy during the middle of the meeting, with the mayor interrupting Councillor Schaefer to chastise him about his word choices, and then complaining himself about being interrupted. Insert eye roll emoji here. At the work session meeting on Thursday, City Council and staff began a multifaceted conversation about our downtown business area. As this is the beginning of a conversation that will likely take place over the course of 3 to 6 months or longer, it might not seem very interesting to community members at large, but it did include side conversation into items such as changing the city charter and developing a tax increment financing district, aka urban renewal. And after all, this is a discussion about our money and what to do with it, so if it's not interesting now, it will be later, so why not pay attention early? All right, partly as a result of the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force and the discussion of a civic campus, there has been renewed attention on the state of our downtown. Why is it not more like Albany's? When will downtown get some wow? What can the city do to support our small business owners and our downtown merchants? Will keeping the city administration buildings in the downtown area be enough to foster thriving, successful downtown businesses? The first item at hand was to discuss past and future ways to help support the downtown. In the past, Corvallis has been an active participant in the Oregon Main Street program. This is a state program for commercial historic district revitalization that is designed to build high-quality, livable, and sustainable communities that grow Oregon's economy while maintaining a sense of place. If it sounds like I just read that off the webpage, I did. Being a Main Street community provides access to grant funding and other promotional perks for the downtown. Membership in the program cannot be managed by the city itself and must be managed through a nonprofit composed of members of the downtown business community. In years past, the downtown business owners had such a nonprofit organization called the DCA, the Downtown Corvallis Association, but it dissolved in 2022 for reasons too complex to cover today. With remarkable timing, a new nonprofit has formed in Corvallis, the DCO, or Downtown Corvallis Organization, and the city staff and the council discussed moving forward with the idea of granting this organization the reins of control for Corvallis to reinvigorate its participation in the Oregon Main Street program. People interested in learning more about this can look online at downtown-corvallis.org and at mainstreet.org. The conversation next moved into a discussion about a potential downtown urban renewal district. The use of the term urban renewal has become unpopular and has been replaced by the more modern terminology tax increment financing, also known as TIF. But regardless of what you call it, here we are again with the money conversations. And the city council might all agree that a TIF for downtown is great, but Section 57 of the Corvallis City Charter states that any collection or use of tax increment funds for any purpose whatsoever must be approved in advance by a majority vote at a city election. The staff report included the fact that our city charter language leaves room for confusion on this topic, which in turn led to the city council discussing that this is one more reason to update our city charter in 2025. Charter amendments also require a vote of the public, and Councilor Gabe Shepherd recommended that the council be strategic about their approach to the idea of voting on both a TIF and charter amendments in the same year. In the end, City Council gave the nod to staff to look at what it would take to add a tax increment finance district to the city's operational plan and budget for 2025, and the City Council will consider revising Section 57 of the City Charter during the charter review process that is set to take place this coming year. It will be up to the voters to stay informed about these topics as the discussions continue. There are a few short and sweet additional items of interest from the week's city meetings. Near the end of the meeting on December 2nd, Councillor Ellis requested the council ask for a change to the agenda for the final work session of the year, the one on December 16th. She suggested it was more appropriate to delay the start of the conversation of how to pay for the new civic campus until all of the new council members are in their seats. The mayor said he would consider that request. During the second half of the work session meeting on December 5th, the City Council interviewed 5 applicants for the 3 vacancies on the Planning Commission. I was encouraged to see the fresh faces of those who have raised their hands to volunteer to help steward the future of land use planning for Corvallis. Lastly, a note about the South Corvallis Area Plan information. On November 21st, the City of Corvallis Community Development Department hosted an open house at Lincoln Elementary School, where they unveiled their newest draft for zoning changes proposed in the South Corvallis area. Many of the residents present at that open house were surprised by what they saw, and a contingency of them came to the City Council meeting on December 2nd to express their concerns. I'll be doing my best to continue to follow that issue and give you updates here. Thanks for joining me here on the Corvallis Civics Cafe. If you have comments or feedback, send them to me via email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's news, music, and civics, you can email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, this is Wendy Byrne for KORC.
You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an article from the Central Oregon Daily News, dated December 2nd, 2024. Headline, Oregon introduces new statewide recycling rules to combat plastic waste. And the article is written by Alex Baumhard. Starting next summer, Oregonians across the state will begin to receive a standardized list of what can and cannot be recycled statewide. And owners and managers of apartment complexes and multi-unit housing will need to prepare to provide recycling for residents. These are among new rules around recycling finalized recently by Oregon's Environmental Quality Commission following 4 years of negotiation and planning. The Plastic Pollution and Recycling Modernization Act will go into effect July 1, 2025. Making it easier for Oregonians to recycle. It will establish new packaging fees for companies selling products in Oregon based on the weight and recyclability of the material. Hard-to-recycle materials, such as plastics, will command higher fees from companies than products that are easily recycled, ideally incentivizing producers to choose lighter, more sustainable materials. This follows regulations in Oregon in recent years that require manufacturers to pick up some of the end-of-life costs of paint, mattresses, and electronics, or to invest in programs to recycle such products. Senator Michael Dembrow, who championed the Plastic Pollution and Recycling Modernization Act in legislature in 2021, said, "Part of the goal is to move companies into more recyclable materials. There is a cost to packaging that needs to be internalized. The rules also give authority to collect and invest some new packaging fees to the Circular Action Alliance, or CCA, a nonprofit based in Washington, D.C. Local governments and the Alliance will be in charge of reinvesting fees in projects that will improve Oregon's recycling infrastructure. The Alliance was formed in 2022 by 20 multinational corporations in the food, beverage, retail, and consumer goods industries, including Amazon, Coca-Cola, and Nestle. It oversees similar recycling programs that are rolling out as a result of new policies in California, Colorado, Maine, and Maryland. Under Oregon's new rules, environmental officials will release a standardized list of items that can be recycled across the state beginning summer of 2025. Owners and managers of multifamily buildings, such as duplexes and apartment buildings, will also need to eventually provide recycling services for residents. Two other bills passed in Oregon in 2023 will require manufacturers to label products to indicate whether and where they can be recycled in Oregon and ban the use of styrofoam containers for takeout food. The latter, Senate Bill 543, will go into effect in January 2025. Rules under Senate Bill 123, the Smart Labeling Bill, must be finalized by 2027. No nation on earth produces more plastic waste than the U.S., according to a 2022 report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. The average person in the U.S. in 1980 produced about 60 pounds of plastic waste per year. Today, each person in the U.S. produces more than 200 pounds of plastic waste each year, according to the EPA. Up to 2 million metric tons of that waste escapes into the environment each year, and much of it ends up in waterways and oceans, eventually becoming microplastics. The nonprofit Environment Oregon tested 30 rivers and lakes around the state in 2021 and found detectable levels of microplastics in all of them. Despite efforts to improve plastic recycling, no more than 9% of plastic waste generated in the U.S. each year gets recycled, according to the EPA. That was an article from the Central Oregon Daily News entitled, "Oregon Introduces New Statewide Recycling Rules to Combat Plastic Waste," dated December 2, 2024, and the author was Alex Baumhard. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
For this week's KORC Eco Report, we will learn about one of Oregon's smallest and most elusive carnivores, who's getting some long-deserved attention. You might be able to guess which creature I'm talking about if I said it is also one of Oregon's stinkiest mammals. That's right, we're talking about a skunk, specifically the western spotted skunk, or Spilagale gracilis. The spotted skunk is more, well, spotty than its more common stripy cousin, the striped skunk, which occurs across much of North America. It is found in diverse habitats across the western United States, from southern British Columbia to northern Mexico, but in our region it's mostly been observed in coniferous forests of the Cascade and Coast Ranges. Interestingly, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife states that the western spotted skunk is not believed to live in the Willamette Valley itself, but does occupy most of the state, from old-growth forests to deserts.
He's getting some long.
One reason their range isn't more precisely known is because it is a rarely studied animal, but more on that later. Adult western spotted skunks are boldly striped, black and creamy white, with three longitudinal stripes on each side of the front part of the body, three vertical stripes on the hind part, one pair of longitudinal stripes running either side. Just look at a picture. They're very spotty and adorable. And their complex pattern of stripes and spots is remarkable, setting them apart from other skunks. As with other skunk species, these creatures carry a pair of musk glands just inside their anus, from which they release their musky oil as a spray with powerful muscles. This musk is similar to other skunks, but does contain a compound called 2-phenylethanethiol, which is said to give the spotted skunk a stronger odor, but which does not spread as widely as others, and it's been compared to garlic. Before spraying, they often display plenty of threat behavior, stamping their forefeet and raising their hind into the air to display their warning patterns. If it's time to spray, most often they will bend their body into a U-shape and look directly at their target, up to 15 feet away. About a tablespoon of liquid can be stored at a time, and it takes about a week to replenish. The western spotted skunk is nocturnal and technically an omnivore, but feeds primarily on insects, small rodents, reptiles, and amphibians. They'll also eat eggs and carrion, and can adapt to whatever species are locally available, eating even scorpions in the desert. Their main predators appear to be large birds, such as owls and eagles. As winter approaches each year, western spotted skunks attempt to build up reserves of fat, feeding voraciously. During that time, when many mammals might hibernate, they may only go as far as sleeping for several weeks during the winter. Sometimes females stick together, denning together with up to 20 others. For most of their life, individuals are solitary but will typically mate in September, and skunk embryos will undergo a long period of dormancy until implantation in the spring, with 2 to 5 kits being born the following May. Females become sexually mature at only 4 to 5 months of age. Biologists at Oregon State University have been studying the western spotted skunk in the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest in the Cascade Range east of Eugene. Because there's essentially no scientific research on this species, years of effort have been put into luring, photographing, trapping, and studying them to see where they spend time and to learn more about their life cycle. This includes studying things like diet, habitat requirements, predation pressures, and the effects of logging. Shout out to postdoc researcher Marie Tosa, who shared that she was sprayed between 50 and 100 times over the course of this study, all for the love of biodiversity. Because they're both a predator and a prey, small carnivores like the spotted skunks occupy an important place in the ecosystem's food web. In their study, OSU placed radio collars on spotted skunks and traced their movements. One surprising find was that they have an expansive home range, nearly 12 miles. This far exceeds the range of many larger mammals, for example, the black-tailed deer, which typically lives within about a single square mile. They also found that the spotted skunks may be struggling to adapt to more extreme winter weather. Since they are so elusive and nocturnal, you aren't likely to see one while you walk your dog. However, Dr. Tosa suggested setting up wildlife cameras to catch a glimpse of the western spotted skunk if you live near the Cascade or Coast Ranges.
This is KORC. When you consider the amount of toxic masculinity within American culture, it can be refreshing when an iconic male role model offers a perspective of healthy masculinity. This next clip was recorded on the Arsenio Hall television show when Arsenio was joined by professional wrestler Macho Man Randy Savage. This comes from July of 1992.
Okay, your middle name is Macho, but I'm wondering if you ever cry. You ever had Macho Man ever cried?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh. It's okay for macho men to show every emotion available right there, you know, because I've cried 1,000 times, I'm gonna cry some more. But I've soared with the eagles and I've slithered with the snakes and I've been everywhere in between. And I'm gonna tell you something right now. There's one guarantee in life, and that there are no guarantees, yeah. And I understand this. Yeah. Nobody likes a quitter. Nobody said life was easy, so if you get knocked down, take the standing eight count, get back up, and fight again, and you're a macho maniac. Dig it.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, December 6, 2024. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is Cork.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We have documented Israel's perpetration of 3 out of the 5 prohibited acts under the Genocide Convention since the 7th of October. These include killing members of the group, causing them serious mental or bodily harm, and inflicting conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction.
Amnesty International has become the first major human rights organization to conclude Israel's committing genocide in Gaza. We'll speak to Amnesty's Israel-Palestine researcher. Then, All That Remains, a new Al Jazeera documentary, tells the story of Leon, a 13-year-old girl from Gaza who lost her leg in an Israeli strike.
The doctor told us we had to choose between the girl or her leg.
What happened to Leanne weighs very heavily on me.
To make her feel better, I tell her it isn't just you. It's this kid, that kid, that kid, and that's just who we know.
Leon is one of over 1,000 Palestinian children who lost their limbs in Gaza in the first 2 months of the Israeli assault. Then to France, where President Emmanuel Macron is refusing to resign after lawmakers across the political spectrum united to oust his prime minister. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Syria, the leader of the powerful armed opposition group Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, a former al-Qaeda affiliate, has declared opposition forces have taken complete control of the central city of Hama. In an interview with CNN published today, Abu Mohammed al-Jalani said his group's ultimate goal is to overthrow Syria's authoritarian president Bashar al-Assad. Armed groups now control Hama's military airport and were seen freeing prisoners from the city's jails. They've since pushed further south, claiming complete and rapid control of the northern suburbs of Homs, Syria's third largest city. Overnight, thousands of Homs residents fled toward Syria's western coast. On Thursday, Lebanon's Hezbollah movement pledged its support to the embattled Syrian government, which faces one of the largest challenges to Bashar al-Assad's authority in 13 years of bloody civil war. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Syrians displaced by violence are struggling to survive amidst freezing temperatures. This is Shafika Saida, a Yazidi Syrian whose family fled to a camp in northern Syria.
We were staying in Al-Shahba. They said the Free Syrian Army would enter the area. We were afraid because there were women with us. We were afraid that they would kidnap them from us. Our baby grandson was born on the third day here. We were sleeping outside. There was no tent or anything. We didn't find anything to eat when we got hungry, and there were no ovens to cook. The baby was born here, and we named him Afrin, after our city.
The Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza has again come under intense attack by Israeli forces who stormed the beleaguered hospital, making arrests and ordering others to evacuate. Kamal Adwan's director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, also reports many deaths and injuries from Israeli strikes, including 4 medical workers who were killed. Dr. Abu Safia, who himself was severely wounded in Israeli attack last month, called the situation catastrophic. in southern Gaza, a director of a soup kitchen in Al-Mawasi in Khan Yunis, says many families rely solely on one meal per day from his operation after the World Central Kitchen paused its Gaza distributions following an Israeli airstrike that killed three more of its workers last weekend.
Now the ghost of famine is beginning to appear here in the southern Gaza Strip. These families can't afford even the low-priced materials and have no source of food except from this charity. Families are relying on this soup kitchen as their only means, as they have found their haven in it. Currently, we are serving more than 800 families, equivalent to approximately 4,000 people.
French President Emmanuel Macron dismissed calls to step down Thursday as he addressed the nation following the collapse of the French government in a no-confidence vote.
The mandate you democratically gave me is a five-year mandate, and I will carry it out fully until the end. We cannot allow ourselves to be divided or to do nothing. That's why I will name a prime minister in the coming days. I will ask them to form a government in the general interest, representing all the political parties who can participate in it, or at least who agree not to bring it down.
The leader of the Socialist Party met with President Macron today and urged him to meet with the heads of leftist parties as the president selects a new prime minister. On Thursday, Donald Trump tapped Rodney S. Scott, his previous head of Border Patrol, for Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, and Caleb Vitello as acting director of ICE, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Trump's vowed to enact mass deportations as soon as he returns to office. In other transition news, President-elect Trump selected venture capitalist, former PayPal COO David Sacks, as his AI and crypto czar. The created position won't require Senate confirmation or financial disclosures, though it's likely to directly benefit Sacks' various business interests in Silicon Valley. Sacks is a close ally of Elon Musk and is expected to push for more deregulation. In related news, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, tapped by Trump to run a proposed Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, met with Republicans on Capitol Hill Thursday to push plans to dismantle the federal government. New federal filings confirm Musk spent over $250 million to help elect Trump. The far-right Heritage Foundation, which created Project 2025, said it's spending $1 million to lobby Republican senators to confirm Pete Hegseth as Secretary of Defense amidst backlash over his history of sexual assault, misusing funds in his previous positions, possible ties to white nationalists, and various violations committed while drunk in public. He once yelled, "Kill all Muslims," while out at a bar during a work trip. Meanwhile, House Republicans on Thursday voted to block the release of Matt Gaetz's ethics report following an investigation into allegations that Gaetz was involved in the sex trafficking of an underage girl. He withdrew from consideration as attorney general. Trump's transition team has prepared a list of countries to which it may deport asylum seekers when their home countries refuse to accept them. That's according to NBC News, which reports the arrangement could lead to hundreds of thousands of people becoming permanently displaced in countries where they have no connection to communities, language or culture. On Thursday, the governments of the Bahamas and Turks and Caicos said they oppose Trump's deportation plans. Panama and Grenada are reportedly also on Trump's list. Meanwhile, an investigation by The Guardian newspaper finds the Biden administration has for the past year been in the process of extending at least 14 contracts with private sector immigration jails across the United States and exploring options for expanding detention capacity. That's despite Biden's past statements opposing for-profit prisons over their long record of human rights abuses. In climate news, a Biden administration official has told the International Court of Justice in The Hague that historical greenhouse gas emissions should not be considered wrongful acts. State Department legal advisor Margaret Taylor made the argument during a landmark climate case brought by low-lying island nations who face an existential crisis caused by wealthier polluting nations.
International human rights law, however, does not obligate states to mitigate anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions. Nor does it currently provide for a human right to a healthy environment. acts or omissions that preceded the crystallization of international obligations with respect to climate change cannot be internationally wrongful acts.
Representatives for China made similar arguments, saying UN climate change negotiations should be the only channel for global climate governance. That prompted sharp criticism from Vanuatu Special Envoy for Climate Change, who also called out the governments of Australia and Saudi Arabia for attempting to shrug off responsibility for historical emissions. In North Carolina, the town of Carrboro has filed a lawsuit against one of the country's largest electric utilities, accusing Duke Energy of contributing to global heating and lying to the public about the climate crisis. It's the first lawsuit of its kind in the United States. Plaintiffs say Duke Energy waged a deception campaign to hide the role of fossil fuels in exacerbating climate change, resulting in delayed action to curb the impacts of greenhouse gas pollution. The suit also alleges Duke continued to operate its coal and gas power plants despite learning about their harms nearly 60 years ago. Carrboro has faced intensifying extreme weather events, including catastrophic flooding. Duke Energy operates six power plants in North Carolina and is the third largest source of carbon dioxide in the United States. UN human rights experts are raising alarm over the criminal prosecution of two climate activists who were arrested in New York this summer during a series of nonviolent protests demanding an end to financing for the fossil fuel industry. Alex Conan and John Mark Rosendahl were taken into custody during protests against Citibank and criminally charged with assault and criminal contempt. The assault charge was later dropped, and both climate activists then pleaded guilty to the lesser charge of disorderly conduct. Rosendahl, who is a professional cellist, was arrested in August for performing a piece by Bach during a protest. In a victory for environmental activists, Norway's socialist lawmakers have temporarily halted Norway's plans to move forward with deep-sea mining in the Arctic Ocean by agreeing to support the government's 2025 budget in exchange for the pause. In January, Norway's parliament voted to allow deep-sea mining exploration in a swath of its Arctic waters about the size of the United Kingdom, which scientists warned would severely harm vulnerable ecosystems and even drive species to extinction. On Capitol Hill, police arrested over a dozen transgender advocates, including Chelsea Manning, as they staged a bathroom sit-in protest at a congressional restroom near the offices of House Speaker Mike Johnson and Congressmember Nancy Mace. They chanted, "Our bodies are no debate." The protests led by the gender liberation movement came after Congressmembers Mace and Johnson imposed restrictions on transgender and non-binary people using congressional bathrooms ahead of trans Congressmember-elect Sarah McBride's swearing-in next month. And the health insurance company Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield has reversed a new policy imposing time limits on coverage for anesthesia during surgeries in Connecticut, New York, and Missouri. The policy, which was set to go into effect in February, was announced in November but went viral earlier this week in the wake of the killing of UnitedHealthcare's CEO. The news provoked major outrage from the public, elected officials, and the medical community. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, December 6, 2024. This is Cork, News, Music, and Civics. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is KORC.
Hi, KORC listeners. This is JC, and I've had the wonderful opportunity of being able to sit down with Henry Jackson Jr., who's a local artist that I really want to highlight today. How you doing, Henry?
I'm doing great. How about you, JC?
Just great, thank you. So, Henry,
I'm just going to start off by asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I'm Henry Jackson Jr. That's my stage name. I've lived in Albany my whole life. Half my family lives here. So I'm 16 years old. I'm a junior in high school. And really now, just getting into this music thing. So I've been writing music since I was like in fifth grade, but I feel like I haven't been like taking it seriously until like the last year or so. And I love it so much. It's my favorite thing in the world to do.
Henry, I had no idea that you were still in high school.
Yeah. So, this year I actually decided to take all my classes, but one online, so I could kind of have freedom of schedule to spend more time pursuing music and really kind of bet on myself in my last 2 years in high school.
So you go to Albany High School?
Yeah, I'm at West Albany.
West Albany, okay. Yeah. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your genre? What draws you to the style of music that you've chosen?
I have two different approaches. So I'm in a band, and the band's always like rock and metal and stuff like that. When it kind of comes to my solo music, my goal is trying to just create something that's unique, and I want each song to have a different feel. I'm always trying to push things to make something that's not like the last one. So there's like a lot of influence from like Jeff Buckley and Pete Townsend from The Who, Mark Bolan from T-Rex, guys like that. Just kind of always came up with weird stuff, and so that's kind of what I try and do my best.
And just listeners, for your information, we're going to feature Henry's latest song, I'll Wait, here at the end of our segment. So tell us a little bit about the band you're in, first of all.
We've been through a lot of name changes and lineup changes recently, but we just got in a new drummer and guitarist. So I think, really feel like this group is going to be meshing good. And the hope is to be starting to set up gigs by January or February. Right now, We're Midnight X. It'll probably change at some point because we're bad about deciding on a name. But if anybody's interested in finding us, we got an Instagram. So you can find us at Midnight X on Instagram and kind of keep up with stuff as it goes.
Does Midnight X do original music or covers? And tell us about some of the bands that they cover, if you could. Yeah.
Yeah. So we do both. Right now, we're just kind of getting a set list rolling because we just gotten two new people. But as of right now, we're doing four covers and four originals. We're covering My Own Summer by Deftones. We're covering a Misfits song. This is called Saturday Night. We're doing Metal Health by Quiet Riot. And then what's the third one we're doing? We're doing Mother by Danzig, because I'm a huge Danzig fan.
So you said Midnight X has some original music too.
Yeah, I've been writing music for like a band for like a full arrangement for a while now. So I got a lot more songs that we're ready to start working in soon. We have a few live videos. We played a Battle of the Bands. We kind of had some difficulties with the sound guys at the venue.
Oh, okay.
So after the first song, they kind of just said, you know what, we're going to turn everybody down but the drummer. So you just hear drums after the second song.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's hilarious. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry.
It was pretty brutally ironic, too, because I think the reason they were mad at us was because of our drummer, because he was kind of complaining about their kit. And then they were like, okay, we'll just turn him up as loud as it gets. I'm like, awesome.
That was their solution.
I kind of felt like they didn't take us seriously because of our age, but it was fine. It was a fun time. We had fun performing, and that's what mattered. And people get to see that, and people enjoyed us.
Absolutely. So exposure is important. Absolutely. So all of the members of your band are around your age?
I'm the youngest one. So everybody's 18 or 19, and then I'm 16. So yeah, but we're all relatively young.
Could you tell our listeners why? Because your genre, when you're doing your solo work, sounds a little bit more folk than, you know, like you mentioned, Jeff Buckley, for example. It really does sound that way. And I really like your sound. I think you have a really, you're early. Listeners, just for your information, Henry is early, but he's got some talent. I'm really impressed, particularly on your YouTube channel. Could you tell listeners why, instead of doing metal personally, yeah. you're doing more of a folk approach? What brings you to that place?
So when I started writing music, that was kind of like what I wrote at first. So it's always come more natural. And I listened to just so much music. I listened to a really wide variety of stuff. So like growing up, some of the bands that I loved the most were like the Decemberists, which if people don't know them, they're from Oregon, and probably the best variety of songwriting you will hear. Just phenomenal stuff. So I grew up with that, like Avett Brothers, Devil Makes Three. So it was always this more folk-driven stuff that I grew up on. So that's kind of like where my roots lies. And so I think when I just started playing guitar, it was just like, okay, this is what is like ingrained in my head. Like, this is the go-to. And then as I went on and listened to more music and expanded my taste, then I was kind of like, rock music is pretty awesome. Like, I want to do this too. And there are some solo songs, like especially some stuff that I think I want to record on the second or third album that are going to be full arrangement. They're going to be some more like rock stuff that I just don't think quite fits what I want to do with Midnight X. But I kind of just want the solo stuff to be just everything kind of mushed together. And that way people can pick and choose what they want to listen to. They don't have to listen to all of it because they might not like all of it. That's okay.
Because you have such a wide array of love of different genres of music, that's kind of your goal? Is that what you're kind of saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's emerging young artist Henry Jackson Jr., and that's Jaxson, who lives in Albany and who's just starting his musical journey. Next up, he's going to talk about his goals in life, where he's played, and whether or not he wants to stay local.
So being so young and so prolific in your music, could you tell our listeners, what are some of the things you're working toward adulthood?
Yeah, so music is really what I want to pursue, and that's what I hope to pursue. And that's why I kind of feel like I gotta get started now when I'm young. I'd love for music to be my full-time job, and I'd love to be able, ideally what I want to do is with the doorways that I've created through music, I want to be able to throw big like events. I want to do a lot of fundraisers, a lot of philanthropy based stuff. I want to help people as much as I can, because that's what music has always been for me. Music has helped me out. So I want to try and do my best to repay that. And all the people that supported me when I was like super young, or like even that still support me today, I want to be able to kind of inspire other young people to get into music, because it's the best thing in the world.
So we can look forward to maybe some years of hearing about you, hearing from you, and
that's the hope.
Just being out in the community then.
Yeah. Yeah.
So are you wanting to stay local, or are you thinking about moving, or any thoughts on that?
I definitely think moving once I graduate from high school is a possibility. I'm open to going to college. I don't necessarily want to. I'm not a big fan of school, but I'm definitely willing to. So I think it kind of is going to depend on where music is at the end of my senior year, and be like, okay, am I ready to just launch pad into this and pursue this full time? Or do I need to wait a little bit longer and build up some more stuff? And so if I go to college, I may potentially move. I love the Oregon area though. And I always want to, no matter what, if I'm playing music, come back and play music here. But I want to play music everywhere. I want to play music all around the world. That's the hope.
Excellent. So could you see yourself someday being a national and international musician? Is that what you're thinking?
I'd love to.
Keep in mind, everyone, listeners, Henry is 16 years old, and he may sound like he's a full-blown adult, but he's on his journey, his young musical journey, and I'm just so thrilled to be highlighting you, Henry. So have you played some venues, either with Midnight X, your band, or in solo, and are there any venues in particular that you would like to be a part of and that you're legally able to be part of?
Well, so thankfully, I think, as far as I'm aware, in Oregon, there's a law that permits you to play in bars as a performer. You just can't stay in the bar once you're done performing. So that's something that's pretty nice. I know sometimes you have to deal with paperwork and all that. I haven't definitely played as many shows as I hope to. Midnight X and I, we played the show at the Greyhound Tavern and then they sadly closed down. I haven't much as many. I'm a bit bad about scheduling solo gigs. That's something I need to start doing is reaching out and setting stuff up. But I've played a lot of like open mics and jams. Every other week, I go down to Eugene and play at this phenomenal nightclub down there, Max Pub, at a blues jam there, and that's always a blast and just such a good community, such a fun time. And I think that's really, really helped me come into my own as a performer. Just kind of just getting to go up there and just have fun with a bunch of musicians who are loving it as much as I am. Yeah, Max Nightclub and restaurant.
So listeners, be aware, and this is something new to me. This is wonderful to hear. So listeners can check you out on their open mic night, I'm assuming?
Yeah, so it's a blues jam. I go the second and fourth Tuesday of every month, and it runs, I think we start around 6. It runs around 6 to 9, and we just bunch of blues musicians. We just go up there and just give it our all and have a good time.
Sounds like somewhere I might have to travel.
It's such an amazing place.
Last but not least, I really would like to ask you how listeners can have access to your music, to hear you in your musical journey and how you develop.
Yeah, so I'm available pretty much everywhere you listen to music, just whatever your streaming service of choice is. Just look up Henry Jackson Jr., and Jackson is spelled J-A-X-S-O-N, and you can find me there. Just released the newest song, which JC's going to share with you guys in a bit, called All Wait. And this Saturday the 7th, I got another song coming out, and there'll be a final single, and then early in January, it's going to be a full album coming out. So I'm so excited to share all that with everyone.
Reminder listeners, J-A-X-S-O-N. So Henry, what is the name of your full album? Have you chosen a name yet?
Yeah, the name is Hallway. I think it's The Hallway, because that's a line from the first song I released off of it called Migraine, and that was actually the original name of the song. I felt like it gives the right vibe, because I want the whole thing to sound kind of DIY. Even though I did get the joy of going into a studio and recording it, we went very minimalistic, very bare bones on all of it, and that's why I wanted to share. I wanted it to be more about the content of the song than big old production and distracting you and all that.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. That really helps our listeners understand the it's not folk, but kind of. And I like how you say DIY. It's like, I look at it more like indie folk, if there's such a genre.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally.
Well, Henry, thank you so much for not just being interviewed today, but just for adding to the beauty of the world through your music. We really appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a fantastic time.
All night for your call. I'll be here, and you know that I am waiting for you. I'm burning at 1,000 degrees. I'm yearning for what I can only dream. I was looking for someone like you. I was searching, but now, baby, that's all through. And the minute I go to sleep, you're the only thing my heart tells my brain to see. And what do you expect me to do? I'm gonna wait, I'm gonna care, I'm gonna tell you just what you need to hear. And maybe someday you could be mine. Girl, I ain't gonna go and leave, haven't hardly been getting much sleep. I'll be here, and you know that I am waiting for you.
Emerging artist Henry Jackson Jr., J-A-X-S-O-N, a 16-year-old artist who lives in Albany. And that's his song, I'll Wait, which is a sample from his upcoming album, The Hallway, which will be dropped in early January. Henry played guitar, upright bass, piano, and did all the vocals for that album. He also composed all of the songs. Let's give Henry some love, and we're going to try and feature him in the future. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
I smoke cigarettes for 24 years, one pack a day. That is called 12-pack years. If I smoked 2 packs a day, it would be 48-pack years, or 1 half-pack a day would be 12-pack years. Pack years measure the years of exposure to smoking tobacco and the 7,000 chemicals created by burning cigarette. I thought I was smoking tobacco, never thought about inhaling pesticides, additives, and chemicals, including those from burning cigarette paper. But my quitting had nothing to do with chemicals, health issues, anti-smoking advertising, or social pressures. I did not quit for family or to add years to my life, nor did I quit to prevent the holes in my beautiful silk ties. Quitting was not an instant decision. It took me years to become willing to quit. I became willing because I started getting short of breath. I felt like I was suffocating, drowning. That scared me. It amazed me how quickly I got my breath back after quitting. And after only 1 year, I felt like I had never smoked. For information on how to quit, call 800-QUIT-NOW or go to smokefreeoregon.com. My name is Donald Russell. I have lived in Corvallis, Oregon for over 25 years.